Welcome to Soundboard, your source for news, culture, and community issues in Central Virginia. My name is Lewis Rainey. Soundboard airs every Saturday at 6 a.m. on WTJU 91.1 FM and also podcasting as part of the Teej FM network. That's TEEJ.FM. Tune in, subscribe, and find out what's happening in your community and around the state. Later in the show, we'll talk to Richmond-based journalist Peter Galaska about Virginia politics, plus a piece on the legacy of former First Lady Michelle Obama in celebration of Women's History Month. But right now, we're joined here in the studio by Giles Morris. He's the executive director at Charlottesville Tomorrow, as well as Elliot Robinson, news editor, to talk about a development project in the Belmont neighborhood that recently went before the Planning Commission. So can you guys start out by just telling us a little bit about the current state of this development proposal in the Belmont neighborhood?
The proposal for something on this small piece of property in Belmont has been about 5 years in the making, and once again is going to hit the city council. On Tuesday, the Planning Commission voted to endorse rezoning two parcels on Lyman Street. It's a very small street near the railroad tracks, and it's in the northern part of Belmont near the Belmont Bridge. The property would have a special use permit if approved through the city council, and that would allow for three 2,500 square foot homes to be built on the lots, which are about a fifth of an acre. Although the Planning Commission voted in favor of the special use permit and the rezoning, it came after some frustration from commissioners because the homes will most likely be expensive and won't do anything to help the city's affordable housing crisis. The square footage of the three buildings combined is just under the trigger for providing funding to the Affordable Housing Fund.
And wasn't the backdrop of that, of this current plan, also the rejection of an earlier proposal to put higher density apartments in?
Right. In 2013 and 2014, Bruce Wardell, who owns the property, he first proposed putting an apartment building there with six housing units, and neighbors in the surrounding area spoke out against it at the Planning Commission level and the City Council level. And the City Council at the time ultimately voted it down. He wanted to put the buildings in the downtown extended zoning area, which would allow for higher uses and less of a parking restriction since the area is a bit tight there.
There's sort of this like ongoing conversation about the city saying we need more affordable housing, you know, activists, neighborhood organizations, community groups all kind of affirming that this is a main priority for our city. But then when it comes practically down to how do you contend with a market for housing that is really off the charts and skyrocketing in expense and therefore incentivizing developers to do this kind of stuff, build nice single family homes at high price points, that's the best way to make money right now.
Right. So I think that gets to the next question I was going to ask you both, which is, and you've touched on it some already, how this individual development sort of plays into that larger conversation. And as you're saying, it sounds like the duality of, on the one hand, the aspirations and the large public push for more affordable housing versus the individual projects that are going on that maybe don't necessarily line up with that. What was interesting, though, when you talk about that is the response from some residents in the article that seemed to celebrate that this was not denser housing. So
right.
Can you talk a little bit about sort of the reaction from residents?
All of the residents who spoke at the meeting were completely in favor of putting up the three homes. One of them even said that he was relieved that the proposal didn't have a high density component. And some of them were the same people who were at previous meetings in 2013 and 2014 that were speaking against the higher density.
So it's kind of like this idea of, what a citywide discussion around affordable housing looks like, and then in the neighborhood level, what an actual neighborhood reaction or response that provides feedback to the public bodies who oversee these processes looks like, right? And so that's where the rubber hits the road between sort of people's broad ideas about policy and then like their NIMBY interests, not in my backyard interests, slash self-interests in what happens in close proximity to them. How does it affect their own property values? How does it affect their quality of life? You know, and what are the other motivations for them? And I think the Twitterverse had some response to your story as well, didn't it, Elliot?
Yes, it's causing a lot of well, it made a big splash on Twitter so far today, where a lot of the people here who are interested in land use have said that this is an example of how hard it is to get affordable housing in the city.
So given the difficulty in sort of merging what you're looking at when you're looking at policy or you're looking at from a top-down perspective versus when you're on the ground and you're in that neighborhood, are there any proposals, particularly in light of what's happened now, for how we do this, how we do affordable housing effectively?
I think I'll let Elliot kind of take a crack at what's actually happening in the Planning Commission's discussions and how it might interface with some of the discussions that were fueled during the comprehensive planning process. But it's just basically, you know, the way policy works is, you know, you have carrots and you have sticks, you know, you have incentives and you have enforcement mechanisms. And then you also have precedents. Right, which is, and in a case like this one, you know, the Planning Commission had no policy framework or precedent through which they could reject this proposal in a fair way. So they voted for it nearly unanimously, but they grumbled about it because it's against their large framework of priorities, which is to incentivize affordable housing development, particularly in the downtown corridor, which this is in Belmont, but like you said, it's right next to the railroad tracks. It's right across from City Walk. It's right in the shadow of a bunch of commercial buildings, right? I mean, it's a very urban place that would be very, you would think, would be amenable to a denser sort of apartment framework. But frankly, everybody wants to live in walkable single-family home Charlottesville when it's down to them, and the market sustains those prices and that demand. So in order to contend with that, the city is going to have to really think hard about adjusting its carrots and its sticks and making very clear rules for developers through small area plans, through rezoning, through precedents around these special use permit hearings, and build a kind of logic that people can respond to. Otherwise, it's very hard on a case-by-case basis to enforce your priorities.
All right. At the moment, another proposal that's in the planning process is 500 units at Seminole Square Shopping Center, where the giant grocery store used to be, but waiting for parking lots of shopping centers and strip malls to become a solution isn't a fully viable solution.
But that's another one where it's like people saw the plans for the building and they're like, ew, no, disgusting, don't Nova Charlottesville. But then it's like everyone's bawling for more affordable housing units, more residential stock, so to take some sting out of the price pressure. Then we also get emails every now and then saying, why doesn't Virginia build 3,000 more dorm rooms to house all of its undergraduates? So it takes some of the rental price pressure out of play, where this is an incredibly expensive place to rent and landlords can basically do as they please in that environment. And a lot of that has to do with the demand from students for off-campus housing.
So I think you mentioned another project in the works already. In this larger conversation about affordable housing, what are we looking towards next in that conversation?
I guess the thing that needs to be done next is the city has to finish the comprehensive plan. It's at the moment, just the work on it has halted. They're waiting for some outside help to come in to help refine some last little bits of it. And then there's also the overall plan for zoning in the city, which they're radically shifted of how that's going to look. And that needs refinement and going to other hearings and getting approval. So now we're in sort of this weird holding pattern where it's clear that some developers are waiting to see how this shakes out before they do something, and then there's others that are pushing to get things in before everything changes.
Mm-hmm. And then there's also this, you know, the way that policy, once it's adopted, I mean, the comprehensive planning process has taken forever, and the land use chapter, and specifically the priorities around housing, have been the last piece, but that conversation is moving very fast amongst housing advocates in town. I think it's going to be hard for the comprehensive plan to actually even catch up to where the conversation is in a certain way. And so you're going to have these kind of case-by-case frameworks, like small area plans for Cherry Avenue or for New Hill, where you're going to see how whatever those larger priorities are, how they actually get implemented in areas. And, you know, it can be really confusing. Right now they're talking about downzoning parts of Fifeville in the context of the small area plan and upzoning parts of North Downtown, right? And it's like, wait, right. I think just for residents to get their head around, you know, the jargon and the terminology and what the enforcement mechanisms are, it's just going to take people getting involved in these more community-focused conversations around their neighborhoods, but not always defaulting to a sort of NIMBY/self-interested lens, and that's hard for human beings to do.
Giles Morris is the executive director and Elliot Robinson, news editor at Charlottesville Tomorrow. Find out more and read the latest at charlottesvilletomorrow.org. You're listening to Soundboard here on WTJU 91.1 FM and the Teej FM network. TEEJ.FM. WTJU and Teej FM are both a service of the University of Virginia. Opinions expressed on this show are, of course, just that, opinions, not the positions of the University of Virginia.
Well, we turn now to state news, and we're joined by our regular correspondent on news out of Richmond and elsewhere in the state here in Virginia, Peter Galaska. He's a journalist based in the Richmond area. Peter, how are you?
Good.
Good. So you sent me an article that's a new report that's out, highlighting climate change and toxic flooding and the threats to vulnerable communities here in Virginia. Take me through what this report's about.
Yeah, this report is done by two men, Noah Sachs, who's a law professor at University of Richmond, and the other man is David Flores, who's with the Center for Progressive Reform. And what they've done is that they've looked at the fact that up and down the James River watershed, there are a number of potential chemical threats if you have either rising water from global warming or flooding. And this came to a kind of a head or attention in the recent couple of years with hurricanes farther to the south of here. It also sort of seems, it's not the same thing, but it does sort of comes at the heels of the coal ash situation, which now, of course, has been better steps to take care of that have been taken. But they point out that there's something like, you know, 1,000 industrial facilities up and down the James that store or discharge some kind of toxic chemical. And this affects, oh gosh, maybe 473,000 people of the almost 3 million people in the James River watershed. So it's kind of an interesting story, and it takes things a step further.
So what should be done about this? That's a lot of you know, dangerous stuff in areas that could be prone to flooding in the future.
Well, I think one of the things which apparently they've already done is to identify them, and then to take steps to, to make sure that the facilities, the tanks or whatever they are shored up and would be above, you know, certain flood levels. I just want to point out one thing. It's not terribly relevant, but it is in a way. Just a few years ago in West Virginia, on a tributary of the Kanawha River, this is not really weather-related, but a pipe leaked or a tank leaked that contained chemicals to wash coal. Well, that turned out to affect the entire drinking supply of Charleston, West Virginia, which is the state capital. And people were drinking bottled water for days and days. This is just a few years ago. But I'm just saying that, you know, it affects people in every way. It affects their drinking water because a lot of people get their drinking water from the James. It just affects fishing. It affects wildlife. It affects everything.
Yeah, so one natural disaster or one, like if it was West Virginia, that case, you know, human-made disaster can,
right.
can make it so there's no water to drink.
Exactly. I mean, that brought things home very, very strongly. I mean, it was pretty dramatic. And, of course, you know, in the James you'd had, you know, going back years, you had the Keypone situation where a pesticide was dumped through a municipal water sewage system into the James, and that resulted in massive pollution, and on it goes. And the recent hurricanes have shown that, especially in North Carolina, where like, you know, dams were breached containing toxic muck. So that's an issue.
So kind of a curious aside, but you found through some old files, you actually did a series for the Richmond Times-Dispatch like almost 40 years ago on hazardous chemical waste in Virginia. Yeah,
that's sort of relevant because that had to do with RCRA, which is the Resource Recovery Act, which is a Superfund thing that came out around that time. And I went around the state. I was on the staff of the Times-Dispatch, and I went all over the state looking at these places where, you know, you had Superfund sites and what they could do about it and how, you know, new storage regimes for these materials was required. It was quite a big thing. Anyway, but that was a long time ago. It was like 1981.
Yeah, well, we're still dealing with really potential pollution, like massive pollution issues that affect, you know,
it's still the same
lives.
Issue.
Yeah, yeah.
So...
Well,
go away.
It doesn't. Somewhat related to that, I want to talk about an op-ed in the Virginia Mercury this week. It's a sort of a post-mortem on the action or lack of action on climate change at the state level in the General Assembly session that just wrapped up. Take me through what they're saying and what you think.
Yeah, this was a special commentary by Ivy Main. And Ivy Main is, she is a prominent lawyer. She has done a lot of work for the Sierra Club. She's also worked for the Environmental Protection Agency. And one of the things that she does very well is that she tracks green bills and renewable bills through the General Assembly, whose session just recently ended. So she's come up with all kinds of regimes about how the General Assembly failed Virginia on clean energy. I want to just, she doesn't really get into this, but I want to say that coal ash was a victory, but that this we're dealing with other stuff that was not. And what she's done is that she's turned it around and showing what could have happened but didn't, that you could have had had bills passed, you could have had a freer and more open market for renewable energy at all levels, you could have more efficient renewable energy, you could have a kind of a fund that would offer no interest loans to local governments, schools, and public institutions of higher learning, that, you know, that would have no interest, but you could use this money to, you know, put in solar panels or wind or whatever, and there would be tax credits for solar on landfills, brownfields, and other things, rebates for low and moderate income Virginians who install solar. But I mean, all of this stuff. Also another thing, we'd be joining the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which is sort of a cap and trade system that's being started mostly in New England and the Mid Atlantic. Virginia may join, but anyway, there's a lot of opposition to that. And these are all things that could have happened but didn't.
Right, right. So what gives?
Well, what gives are a few things did pass in the renewables, but the problem is, as she points out, there are two big impediments to really going a fuller route towards renewables, as other states have done. The leading problem is Dominion Energy, the largest utility in the state, which is very afraid of renewables, first for the reason that they have so many assets tied up and money tied up in things like nuclear and gas and coal. And they're getting more into solar and a little bit into wind, but they're far behind. And the others are the Republicans, who often accept money from Dominion. And so many of these initiatives died in committee in the General Assembly or never got anywhere.
All right. Well, I want to shift the focus a little bit from Virginia up to the federal level. There's a new U.S. House Select Committee on the Climate Crisis, and Virginia is the only state with two members who are going to serve on that committee, and also two members who are from different sides of the aisle. We've got Don McEachin
right.
and Morgan Griffith. Take me through these two men and their takes on the climate crisis.
Well, this is really interesting because Don McEachin, of course, is a longtime politician. He's a Democrat and represents the 4th Congressional District, which is sort of on the south side of the James. And he's a Democrat, of course. And the other gentleman is Morgan Griffith, who's a Republican from way out west in the coal fields. And they're both 15 members selected on the new House Select Committee on Climate Crisis. And it's just to show you the difference. The League of Conservation Voters gave McEachin like very high marks for being green friendly. He got something like a lifetime score of 87% from the League of Conservation Voters. That's McEachin. Griffith, on the other hand, has a 5% lifetime score from the League of Conservation Voters. So I think that figure pretty much sums up everything about how you're getting two people from two different parts of the states, from two different parties, who are around different issues. I mean, McEachin is much more urban in his outlook. And, of course, the other gentleman, Griffith, is really from out in, you know, the mountains.
Well, and not just where they're from, but also, you know, McEachin, the Democrat from the Hampton Roads area, and he says that climate change jeopardizes the world as we know it. You know, it deserves an urgent response.
Well, that's true. And one of the reasons, of course, is that, you know, that general area around Hampton Roads, I mean, you look at the Norfolk Naval Base, you look at Ghent and Norfolk, you look at other places up and down, you know, the James River and the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay and its tributaries, and you're seeing definite signs of, you know, dramatic changes in water levels, especially when you have a storm. And it's not a joke, it's real. Whereas if they're out in the mountains, you know, not so much.
So what do we take from this? Is there going to be any action on climate change at that level with this federal committee?
Well, unfortunately, this is a guess, and only a guess on my part, but I would, of course, favor McEachin over Griffith, but I think that the two kind of, this shows an example of people canceling each other out with the net result of nothing happening. I hate to be cynical, but that seems to be the message.
All right. Well, Peter, on that note.
Hang in there.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
Peter Galaska is a journalist based in the Richmond area.
You're listening to Soundboard here on WTJU 91.1 FM and the Teej FM network, TEEJ.FM. WTJU is supported by the Southern Environmental Law Center, celebrating 30 years of protecting the South's environment and the people who depend on it for health and well-being. Power of the Law, Southern Environmental Law Center. In celebration of Women's History Month, we hear from Peter Slevin, former Washington Post bureau chief and author of the biography Michelle Obama, A Life, who talks about Michelle Obama's early life, expectations surrounding her ascendancy as First Lady, and the impact she will leave on the office. This piece, produced by Josh Schwartz of PRX, was originally recorded in February of 2016.
I was particularly struck by the way she told stories. Told her story, she had a remarkable ability to connect with her audiences. I realized that I wanted to tell her story and to tell it against the history that she lived, which meant starting with Chicago. I'm Peter Slevin. I wrote Michelle Obama, A Life.
Too often, we hear a skewed story about our communities, a narrative that says that a stable, hardworking family in a neighborhood like Woodlawn or Chatham or Bronzeville is somehow remarkable, that a young person who graduates from high school and goes to college is a beat-the-odds kind of hero. And I'm here tonight because I want people across this country to know that story. The real story of the South Side, the story of that quiet majority of good folks, families like mine, who face real challenges but make good choices every single day.
Michelle likes to say that everything she is, everything she became, started in the bungalow where they live, where the Robinsons lived on the top floor. When she was growing up in the 1960s and 70s.
The family made a point of sitting down to dinner together every evening, Aunt Robbie gave piano lessons to the children. Frazier made time when he returned from work to play sports with the kids. He gave Craig a pair of boxing gloves and taught him how to use them. Craig remembers boxing with Michelle, who told the International Olympic Committee in Copenhagen that her father taught her how to throw a ball and a mean right hook better than any boy in the neighborhood.
I think one of the reasons that Michelle connects with so many people and that her story resonates with so many people is that it's familiar.
The Brady Bunch was a particular favorite of Michelle's, and she developed an encyclopedic knowledge of the show. The family typically devoted Saturday nights to games, Chinese checkers, Monopoly, a bluffing game called Hands Down, and later epic Scrabble battles. From an early age, Michelle hated to lose.
As she has said in introducing herself in 2007 as part of what could be the first African-American couple in the White House, our story is not that unusual. You just haven't seen it before. You haven't seen us before.
Look, I can't tell you how many times people have met my mother and asked her, well, how on earth did you ever raise kids like Michelle and Craig in a place like South Shore? And my mom looks at these folks like they're crazy. And she says, Michelle and Craig are nothing special. There are millions of Craigs and Michelles out there. And I did the same thing that all those other parents did. She says, I loved them, I believed in them, and I didn't take any nonsense from them.
What struck me the most was the way Michelle Obama's upbringing, the lessons she learned along the way, the people with whom she connected became such a strong part of what she's doing now. So much of what she's doing connects with issues of race and class that have been part of her life since she was a girl.
They will make assumptions about who they think you are based on their limited notion of the world. And my husband and I know how frustrating that experience can be. The folks who crossed the street in fear of their safety, the clerks who kept a close eye on us in all those department stores, the people at formal events who assumed we were the help.
Virtually overnight, Michelle had become one of the most prominent women in America. The screen was blank, and she was free, if you could call it that, to define a role for herself. Yet she soon discovered that her freedom was defined by a tangle of often conflicting expectations and options.
As potentially the first African-American First Lady, I was also the focus of another set of questions and speculations, conversations sometimes rooted in the fears and misperceptions of others. Was I too loud, or too angry, or too emasculated? Or was I too soft? Too much of a mom, not enough of a career woman.
No one who looked like Michelle Obama had ever occupied the White House. No one who acted quite like her either. She ran obstacle courses, she danced the Dougie, she hula-hooped on the White House lawn. She opened the executive mansion to fresh faces and voices and took her show on the road. Her projects and messages reflected a hard-won determination to help the working class and the disadvantaged, to unstack the deck.
I was born and raised here on the South Side in South Shore, and I am who I am today because of this community. I've visited communities just like this one all across the country, communities that face plenty of challenges and crises, but where folks have that same strong worth ethic, those same good values, those same big dreams for their kids. But unfortunately, all those positive things hardly ever make the evening news.
It's a challenge to write about someone as public as Michelle Obama is. One thing about people who have reached the pinnacle is we think we know their story because we know what's been presented to us. One of the challenges of writing this book was to figure out, in fact, what we don't know, and also to figure out what we could learn about why she is doing the things she's doing. That was a portrait that was possible to draw. It's a little bit like a pointillist painting where you have a million little dots, and if you look at it very closely, they're just a million little dots of different shades. But if you step back, a picture emerges. I'm Peter Slevin. I wrote Michelle Obama, A Life.
Well, that does it for this week's edition of Soundboard, your source for news, culture, and community issues in Central Virginia.